great for staying asleep. Just take a little tincture or a gummy an hour before bedtime, sleep soundly, and wake up without any grogginess. I've been doing the Good Night Oil for ages. It really helps. Brian was actually complaining that it's too good because his back hurts because when he falls asleep with 7 days.
I fell asleep like I was shot in the back of the head in like a crazy position, and I was so knocked out I didn't move for 8 hours.
Really effective and frankly super important these days when there is a lot to keep you up awake at night. Sleep better, feel better, and wake up feeling refreshed, unless you're like Brian, in which case your back will be contorted. Head on over to sunsetlakesabadet.com. Use the code DAYLIGHT26, DAYLIGHT26, no spaces, to save 35% on all their Sabadet sleep products. The sale ends March 9th at 11:59 p.m. Eastern. See their site for additional terms and conditions. We'll put the link at the YouTube and podcast descriptions. Now time for the show.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome them.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Tuesday, March 3rd, 2026. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Anel Shaleen, research fellow at the Middle East program at the Quincy Institute. Then Seamus Malakafazli.
Malakafazli.
Malakafazli. All right. Freelance journalist.
You landed it before the show.
I know. I had it before the show. Of Turbulence Pod and publisher of his newsletter at Seamus Malakafazli .com. Also on the program today, war expands. U.S. shuts embassies in Kuwait and Saudi Arabia. Meanwhile, U.S. expands its bombing of Iran, as does Israel. U.S. casualties now at least 6 and growing, as are abandoned reasons why we launched this war. Meanwhile, Trump and Hegseth both hint at boots on the ground. Rubio claims we attacked Iran because Israel was going to, and Iran will attack, now will attack any ship in the Straits of Hormuz. Tim Kaine.
In the membrane.
Sorry. Tim Kaine says, war powers vote today in the Senate. Key primaries in Texas and North Carolina today. Supreme Court blocks a law prohibiting schools from outing trans students in California. The DOJ backs off its assault on pro bono law firms. Judge restores lawmaker access to ICE detention facilities. In a possible prelude to killing the Voting Rights Act, the Supreme Court intercedes in a New York State Supreme Court congressional district redraw. Stockalopoulos, what's her name? Malakanopoulos?
Malia Stocktips.
Yeah, she's going to keep her district. Bernie Sanders introduces a $4.4 trillion tax on billionaires. That's a 5% wealth tax annually. Graham Platner racks up another Senate endorsement. Sorry, Chuck Schumer.
Time to drop out, Graham.
All this and more on today's Majority Report. I'm already exhausted.
War Day Tuesday.
Yes.
That's what we're We're crossing out Newsday, and now it's War Day. Secretary of War.
It's obviously like the hits keep coming, and Trump and Hegseth. I mean, I don't know. Obviously, we're going to be talking to Anel and Seamus about this extensively today. I do not recall any type of conflict that the U.S. has been involved in, from the Iraq War to Kuwait, the invasion, the first Iraq War that took place in Kuwait, or even invading Grenada. Clinton bombing Libya, or the second Libya bombing, where there was an administration that had seemingly put no effort whatsoever into coming up with a reason why they're doing this, or coordinating the reason throughout the administration. It really is astonishing, and they can't even agree as to whether we are involved in a war or not. Here is a CNN compilation of various elements that are behind this non-war saying it's not a war, even though it's
also a war.
Clearly a war.
You bomb a presidential headquarters or whatever.
You assassinate the leadership of, and then continue to bomb. I'm not sure what else constitutes war.
I think we would consider it a war if someone bombed the White House.
If Iran killed Trump and then also killed hundreds and bombed a school.
We're just being the cops, they said afterwards.
And contemplating boots on the ground, I guess, is really just more about like a field trip type of situation. Here's that compilation.
And we may have casualties. That often happens in war.
I don't know if this is technically a war.
We didn't start this war, but under President Trump, we are finishing it.
This isn't a war. We haven't declared war.
The Secretary of Defense, who calls himself the Secretary of War, said today this is a war.
We set the terms of this war from start to finish.
Nobody should classify this as war. It is combat operations.
War is hell and always will be.
Strategic strikes are not war.
They can't seem to get on the right page. And then yesterday in the morning, Marco Rubio came out with one of, I mean, this is, you know, in every conflict or every era, there are statements that are made that end up being sort of linchpins historically. With the Iraq War, Paul Wolfowitz testified, one of the neocons. I think he was at the State Department during Bush. Maybe it was the Defense Department. I can't remember. I think it was Defense Department. And he said weapons of mass destruction was really the thing that we could just sort of all agree on, because they all had their separate reasons for wanting to invade and occupy Iraq. I'm sure that's the case here. But I think this statement from Rubio, and we will play later in the program Mike Johnson saying something similar, but this is going to be the one that defines
absolutely
this conflict, because on so many levels, it's both disingenuous, it's also absolutely insane, it's also in many ways incomprehensible, and it belies an incredible weakness. Like it really is, honestly, like one of those Escher paintings where you look at it and you can't tell what you're looking at, because it is so wrong in so many different ways. You have to almost like state, like, I'm gonna believe it, and then
yes. And you're not even touching on the how politically insane it is, how toxic politically this statement is, the idea that Israel dragged us into this, and they're admitting it.
Let's play this.
The second question that's been asked is, why now? Well, there's two reasons why now. The first is it was abundantly clear that if Iran came under attack by anyone, the United States or Israel or anyone, they were going to respond and respond against the United States. The orders had been delegated down to the field commanders. It was automatic, and in fact, it bared to be true, because in fact, within an hour of the initial attack on the leadership compound, the missile forces in the south and in the north, for that matter, had already been activated to launch. In fact, those had already been pre-positioned. The third is the assessment that was made that if we stood and waited for that attack to come first before we hit them, we would suffer much higher casualties. And so the president made the very wise decision. We knew that there was going to be an Israeli action. We knew that that would precipitate an attack against American forces. And we knew that if we didn't preemptively go after them before they launched those attacks, we would suffer higher casualties and perhaps even higher those killed. And then we would all be here answering questions about why we knew that and didn't act.
So that's an admission that the Israelis dragged us into it and that they wanted to take action against Iran. And that they needed U.S. support. Because the reality is that last summer, when the Israelis bombed Iran, Israel did a good job of covering up how the Iranian response was actually significant and hit them pretty hard. So they needed U.S. support this time. And Rubio just kind of spells out the reasoning right there.
Well, okay, if we take Rubio at face value, he is both arguing, A, that we had no capacity to stop what Israel is doing, even though we knew that it would seriously implicate us.
Yes.
There would be a cost to pay to us, and we have no ability to stop Israel from doing that. Two, it says
we moved all of our aircraft carriers over there for this exact purpose.
Of course. But wait, this is the version where we pretend he's telling the truth. He's also saying at that point that the logic is we punched this guy in the face because we knew that if someone punched him in the face, he would punch us in the face. Or if we punched him in the face, we punched him in the face because we knew if we punched him in the face, he would punch us back. So we punched him in the face.
Or no, we punched him in the face because our friend was about to punch him in the face, but our friend, it might actually get punched back. So we really stuck up for our friend.
No, we would get punched back. That's what he's saying.
Okay.
We would get punched back.
Okay, gotcha.
And we would get punched back and not know that he was going to punch us back, even though that we predicted this in the first place.
They say we, but they really mean the Israelis here, because if U.S. personnel wasn't in the region and there wasn't this buildup, that is what they're most concerned about, is Iranian missiles breaking through the Iron Dome, and it also hurts Israel's projection of strength. Mearsheimer has spoken about this before, the idea that Israel, because it's such a small nation and doesn't necessarily, and it's a colonial enterprise, needs to show that they are so strong that they can withstand all of this firepower. And Iran is the biggest threat to that. That's why Netanyahu has been trying to drag us into this for 40 years, 30 years. And he successfully lobbied this president, who does not have like the constitutional strength and is arrogant and mad enough to resist the Israeli push, which is now, by the way, bipartisan within the context of Israel. Even the Israeli liberals are endorsing the greater Israel theory. This dotard thinks this is an act of strength because big bombs go boom, even though it's actually a shocking display of weakness because you're being dog walked by Netanyahu.
Now that assumes that what Rubio was saying was true, and it may be. It also, but it really does stretch the imagination.
But why wouldn't it be true? Because admitting that is like the most politically toxic thing that you could possibly do right now within this climate where everybody is sick of Israel and its genocide. Everyone, the polling on
but
the war in Iran.
Toxic to whom?
To the Republicans.
Okay, maybe to some Republicans, but you know, 70% of Republicans still support Israel.
Yes, it was.
I'm
a 10-point
sure Marco
drop.
Rubio, you know, when he's contemplating running for president, maybe in 2028, having the neocons and 70% of the Republican Party behind him. I think he has made his, I mean, there's a reason why J.D. Vance all of a sudden has disappeared, because J.D. Vance had picked a different lane for when he's going to run for president. And that one is sort of like...
But you're now admitting that it's politically toxic. Why would you have to pick a different lane?
No. It's politically toxic depending on who you are.
Yeah.
J.D. Vance had picked a lane and pretending like we're going to be anti-war. Marco Rubio hasn't. From Marco Rubio's perspective, he doesn't see this as politically toxic. I don't think Trump sees it as politically toxic. I think they see it as making sense. I mean, listen.
They're acutely aware that right now there is a right-wing media apparatus. They've lost Matt Walsh that is saying that this is not popular and why are they dragging us into this? And that there's a whole ecosystem of right-wing media influencers right now that say that Israel controls our foreign policy. And he just went and said Israel controls our foreign policy.
I think Donald Trump probably thinks that they're Matt Walsh aside, that he is got more of... loyalty from that Republican base than Matt Walsh or Tucker Carlson or Megyn Kelly, for that matter.
It's just the incoherence of it is also just jarring to me because Trump is just acting like a madman. The Don Rowe doctrine, we were talking about this 2 months ago, that were supposedly the overarching foreign policy objective of this administration was to retreat from the long forever wars in the Middle East. That's what they said. They were lying, and if you paid attention, you would know they were lying. But that we're going to do Western hemispheric dominance now. That's what we're going to be obsessed with. And the only consistency is the desire for blood and lawlessness.
You're just not a flexible thinker.
Yeah.
That's the problem. You're actually stuck in your way.
We're ending the forever war that Iran's doing to us.
Right. Okay. I guess Iran is in greater Western hemisphere.
Yes. You just.
We need to create a buffer zone for the West by bombing Iran.
I think in multiple dimensional chess, and you just think in checkers. Because if you look straight through Washington on a plane, it comes out to Iran right through the planet.
You're right. You're right. I mean, it's just I can't. It's like the way, you know, cats can only see a certain way. That's my femininity. Yeah.
because everything I learn about human dynamics, I experienced that Air America. When you had a lunatic at the head of Air America, people, and actually this happened multiple times, there are different camps within the sort of the administration, and there are, right? We know we have like the Miller camp and the Rust Vote camp. Maybe they are together at times, and J.D. Vance and Rubio and other. And really, all these people are all grifters looking and... The one thing they never do when they don't fight on other people's turf. And so, like, Stephen Miller may have promoted the Don Rowe doctrine, and he had gotten so far. But when Rubio comes in or the neocons come in or Miriam Adelson comes in, Miller backs off. And says, like, it's a mistake, but it's not in my neighborhood. And I think that's
I wasn't
what's
in the
on.
Room.
I mean, honestly, I think that's like, and
apparently, I mean, I heard Trita Parsi say this on American Prestige today. Apparently, Trump is increasingly listening to fewer and fewer people within the official administration, and who he's listening to on this. These are Trita's examples. Are Tom Cotton okay. Not good? Who's the other person? Lindsey Graham, of course, and Laura frickin' Loomer.
But that's going to be this week.
Yes, exactly.
When he starts going into, like, also Cuba now. We're going to do Cuba, and then we're going to do somewhere else. It'll be somebody else.
But the problem is that this is going to take on a momentum in and of itself, and there's going to be a sunk cost fallacy that we saw in Iraq, that the neocons have already got their hooks into him on this front. Like, he doesn't have the consistency or the patience to see anything through. But we know from the nature of regime change wars like this and actions like this that they take on a momentum of their own.
Well, we're going to talk to Anel and to Seamus about this. It's quite possible. He just says, you know what? Actually, I'm done with this. Let's everybody come back and we're going to do something different. Or we end up getting in a protracted another 25-year war. We'll see. In a moment, we'll be talking to Anel Shaleen, a research fellow in the Middle East program at the Quincy Institute. First, a word from our sponsor. I can't even read this without thinking like I want to go back to bed right now, to be honest with you. Cozy Earth crafts every piece with care. From soft, supportive socks for your steps through the day to breathable comforters that help you rest deeply at night. Every detail is intentional, so your everyday feels quietly elevated. I have now Cozy Earth sheets. I got a Cozy Earth comforter, and it was thin. It's thin. I got a mid-weight one.
The duvet thing or the comforter?
Duvet is the cover.
Oh,
right?
Oh, right.
The comforter itself. Oh. So it's not like a big fluffy comforter. It's thinner and it's really, really nice. I mean, I have Cozy Earth. Every time I wear a hoodie, it's my Cozy Earth hoodie. I got joggers that I'm getting ready to break out for spring. Cozy Earth is amazing. I mean, I don't know what to tell you. I got my girlfriend a bunch of Cozy Earth socks. They are soft, breathable, thoughtfully cushioned to support you from your first step to your last. These socks come in four styles, calf, quarter, ankle, and the no-show. I also, myself, have become like quite a quarter sock guy.
Oh.
Yep. I don't know. You know, I'm flexible.
It's never too late to try new things.
You never know where that's
going to go. Yeah, exactly.
The comforters, crafted with intention to support deeper rest, designed with naturally breathable temperature-regulating materials, these luxuriously soft comforters help your body settle, cool, calm, and gently supported through the night. Thoughtful construction creates a cloud-like feel without the heaviness or overheating, making it easier to unwind and feel restored. Comfort and details. Because you feel every day begins with how you sleep. They really do feel like they're constructed well. Cozy Earth purchases are risk-free with their 100-night sleep trial. Try them out. If you don't love them, return them hassle-free. 10-year warranty, because once you feel this level of comfort, you're going to want it to last a decade. Thanks to Cozy Earth for sponsoring this episode. Discover how care in every detail transforms simple routines into moments of true comfort and ease. Head to CozyEarth.com. Use the code MAJORITYREPORT for up to 20% off. That's code MAJORITYREPORT for up to 20% off. And if you get a post-purchase survey, be sure to mention you heard about Cozy Earth right here. Experience the craft behind the comfort. Make every day feel intentional. Quick break. We'll put that information in the podcast and YouTube descriptions. Quick break, and then we'll be back with Anel Shaleen, research fellow in the Middle East program at the Quincy Institute. We are back. Sam Cedar, Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report. It's a pleasure to welcome back to the program Anel Shaleen, a research fellow in the Middle East program at the Quincy Institute. Anel, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I guess the first question, there's a lot of questions, obviously, about this that are really basic. Like, why are we doing this? I'm like, or even why is the administration saying we're doing this? Like, or like what is their answer to this?
I, it's hard to even answer that question because they've been all over the place. You know, I coming out today, that pretty shocking statement from Rubio, the idea that we knew Israel was going to attack. And so that would have meant that Iran would have retaliated and hit Americans. So we decided to just go ahead and attack first. You know, I saw analysis on social media that was like, you know, that's like your teenager is going to go crash the car. And so you get drunk and crash the car instead, you know, to make sure your teenager doesn't do it. It's like, just stop your teenager. You know, like, we have such power over the Israeli government, as was evidenced after Israel struck Doha in September. And finally, Trump made clear to Netanyahu that he needed to at least agree to the appearance of a ceasefire. Obviously, that is not actually what happened. But it was very clear that the leverage is there. And all of this argument that Israel is going to do, you know, the U.S. can't really control. No, we provide them with billions of dollars in security assistance every year. And if we actually put our foot down, they have to listen.
Do you believe that? I mean, no. Not what you just said, but do you believe Rubio? Do you think that we did that? Because, I mean, we've been building up for over a month, right? We've been getting reports for over a month that we have the largest buildup since the Iraq War, both in terms of naval and air power in the region, at least a month, maybe 2 months. But do you believe that Rubio is being genuine in that explanation?
My understanding is that Netanyahu has been pushing for this war. Obviously, we saw the U.S. get involved in June, and then Netanyahu kept pushing for the U.S. to re-engage again, and he was clearly pushing on an open door. I think Trump is on a sugar high after the Venezuela Yes. operation and thought, you know, unclear why he would be under this impression that Iran would be in any way similar to Venezuela, given that there's no indication that the administration had really been in touch with anyone inside Iran. I mean, that would have been fairly shocking, just given the dynamics there and the history of the relationship. But again, in Venezuela, they had been in touch with, you know, Delcy Rodriguez, also Machado. Like, there were various other people waiting in the wings, willing to kind of become a U.S. proxy, and that simply did not exist in Iran. Furthermore, just the fact that you know, something like getting the U.S. bogged down in another war in the Middle East, this is precisely what he said he wasn't going to do. And I know it's silly to hold Trump to anything he said he was going to do, but I mean, how is this America first? Like, I just don't, in terms of like in a midterm year,
important. That's important, right? I mean, I think that's important to note, because when we're looking, I think you're absolutely right that perhaps if the Venezuela operation didn't go the way that it did, and the administration views that as a success because now they have a gun to Rodriguez's head and they're coercing her. If that had not happened, I'm not sure Netanyahu would be able to have convinced Trump this much, because it seems as though Netanyahu and the neocons that Trump has been surrounding himself with recently, although that's not been much of a change, sold him on the weakness of the Iranian regime in a way that does not match the reality. Venezuela is a very different story and has a different history than Iran.
Exactly. And this notion that this was just going to be some easy operation, you know, maybe he felt that the assassination of Qasem Soleimani very early in 2020, he also felt that was successful and there weren't major consequences that he really experienced as a result. But this is very different. And again, as Sam, back to your question about what are they saying they're trying to do? They keep shifting what they're saying, that sometimes it's regime change. Then you have Bridge Colby coming out and saying, no, it's not regime change. And then you have them lengthening the timeline from, you know, we're just going to, you know, we'll go 48 hours and then we'll see if they want to come back to the table. And now it's like, no, it's going to be 4 to 5 weeks. And now maybe it's going to be a ground invasion. You know, Trump being very clear that he doesn't have the yips about putting troops on the ground. I mean, this is crazy. Well, and it's a country of 90 million people. I mean, you know, Iraq was much smaller in 2003, and is just a completely and was a complete debacle.
Okay, I think saying that like Trump has just got rolled in some way, or is, you know, some amount of crazy and stupid. What is, it's taken for granted, you know, that Netanyahu's wanted to do this for 40 years, but what does Netanyahu think was going to happen? Like, you know, I'm not an expert on these things at all, but my understanding about the Iranian government is that there is no, we kill Khomeini and it's and the government collapses. It is very not necessarily decentralized, but institutionalized at this point. And this is not a house of cards. It's actually constructed in a way that is rather durable. What does Netanyahu expect? Like, in his fantasy, we bought, like, does he want American troops on the ground and is okay with a 20-year quagmire for America?
I mean, I don't think Netanyahu has any qualms about Americans dying in this war. I think that's been his objective from the beginning, is to get the U.S. to take out Iran such that it would no longer pose any sort of threat. Again, the idea that Iran posed an actual threat to Israel, when Israel is the nuclear-armed state and Iran is not. I've been shocked by the number of people that have said, oh, is this going to go nuclear? Like, no, they don't have nuclear weapons. Like, what? Israel's the nuclear armed power. But I think what Netanyahu is hoping for is regime collapse. He wants the country to fall apart. We've seen this in addition with the targeting of border areas, in particular the border with Iraq, where you have Kurdish militias,
right,
theoretically, that could come in. Ethnic minority groups inside Iran. I think he's banking on the entire country simply falling apart, which would be extremely destabilizing for the whole region. In particular, you think about countries like Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Qatar, like all the America's Gulf partners on the other side of the Persian Gulf, who've been pushing for this not to happen, who've been pushing very hard for diplomacy. But I think from Netanyahu's perspective, he's not concerned by that. The idea, you know, for as someone who grew up with the War on Terror model and this idea that, like, you can't have these ungoverned spaces and it's better to have, you know, a strong authoritarian government in place than a vacuum. This is it's just sort of shocking to think that Trump has sort of bought into Netanyahu's thinking, which is that total chaos in Iran is somehow desirable.
But wait, I just want to ask you one more question about that. Do the other Gulf states, are they, like, what is the, I understand it from Netanyahu's perspective, a balkanized Iran, an Iran that is engaged in a civil war, an Iran that is a failed state. I mean, I don't know how you get there other than maybe 10 years of American, boots on the ground and some type of massive war, which just seems to me to be an impossibility to sustain in the way that Iraq was. But if that were to happen, why would that not necessarily be in the interest of, let's say, MBS in Saudi Arabia? Like, I mean, they have always been traditionally rivals. I imagine, from their perspective, perhaps a decentralized powers in Iran might make them ascend more. Is that not the case?
So I think that may have been the case a few years ago when the tension with Iran, especially between Saudi Arabia and Iran, was so high. I think that was when you did tend to hear a lot more bellicosity, this sort of rhetoric coming out of Riyadh. But I think more recently, because it has become so clear to the Saudis and the Qataris, the Omanis, that the U.S. security guarantee, alleged security, is not actually there. And we're actually seeing that now, where you have the U.S. concentrating its defenses and the missile interceptors to protect Israel and not to protect these GCC countries that have given Trump personally vast amounts of money, as well as invested in the U.S. economy, enormous amounts of money that obviously there's a lot of corruption happening there, but they would have a reasonable assumption that they sort of bought a degree of loyalty and protection as a result. And instead, what they're finding is, no, the U.S. is not going to be there to protect them. And so this is, and this isn't the first time this has happened. You think about the Iranian attack on the Upcake facilities in 2019, which Trump responded to essentially saying, well, you know, they struck the Saudis, they didn't strike us. And it was after that that you then saw MBS initiating this process that resulted in normalization with Tehran in early 2023, that he decided he couldn't count on the U.S. anymore. He was just going to go ahead and cool down these tensions and just try to find a modus vivendi with Tehran. Obviously, you had the Qataris and Omanis that have essentially been sort of interlocutors with Iran that have had a closer relationship. But just in general, a regional war, as well as the, you know, the possibility of just sort of smuggling or trafficking, you know, Captagon, like when I was in Saudi Arabia in December, this is what they were articulating, was this concern that the U.S. and Israel were going to launch this extreme instability, which is completely incompatible with MBS's Vision 2030, whereby he has staked his credibility and legitimacy on transforming the Saudi economy, to be clear, in an extremely authoritarian manner, but in hopes of reducing their reliance on oil, moving towards a post-oil economy, and it, as well as employing women has been a significant component of that. But he needs foreign direct investment. He needs tourists. He needs it to be, he needs the region to be stable, the same way Dubai and Abu Dhabi and Doha, right, these cities depend on this perception of stability, which has now been shattered.
Iran probably knows that, and that's probably the weakest point in which they can, or the point where they can exercise as much influence.
Yeah, the tourism piece that we saw, we were talking about this before, there were videos of tourists that were saying, how could this happen here? I mean, that their pivot away from oil is going to be, they want more stability in the region for that reason. There was an item in Middle East Eye about how the U.S. is, quote, stonewalling requests from Gulf states to replenish their interceptors. So that fits into what you're saying there. And you also see that they're warming to China. China was part of brokering some of those talks between the Iranians and the Saudis recently. And so they are keeping their options open to a degree. I want to ask you, because you obviously worked in the State Department, we've had you on the show to speak about how you resigned over the genocide in Gaza and the Biden administration not listening to pleas from you and your colleagues to change course. But and so when we talk about Israel's influence over the State Department, you're somebody that has an intimate knowledge of that. I'm wondering, like, about these Kushner and Witkoff talks. Like, on its face, Rubio, as the head of the State Department, should probably be a little bit concerned that the Trump administration and the Israelis seem to relish in the fact that American diplomacy really has no credibility anymore. Because when you have like diplomacy and talks fall apart like this, all that's left is militarism. That's music to Bibi Netanyahu's ears. That's music even maybe to Trump's ears. But like it undercuts the core function of the State Department.
I don't think anyone in the Trump administration is particularly concerned about the State Department, including Marco Rubio. I mean, you know, the fact that you have Kushner and Witkoff not only leading these negotiations with Iran, but also Gaza, also Ukraine. I mean, right, in a previous administration, it would have been conducted through State Department channels, and you would have had sort of the capacity there. To say nothing also with the expertise. And just, I mean, one key point there I think that it's important to highlight is the fact that Trump could have declared victory with the deal that he got. The fact that you had the Omani foreign minister come on Face the Nation to say Iran has agreed to zero enrichment. This had been a red line.
Well, they didn't say zero enrichment. They said zero stockpiling. Right. I mean, so that there would be enrichment, but only it seemed to me that the offer was we continue to enrich for commercial purposes, using it for nuclear power, but no stockpiling. So we can't build a nuclear weapon.
I think that's right. I think and that would have again, Trump could have said, I got something better than what Obama got, because under the JCPOA, the 2015 nuclear deal, Iran was permitted to retain, I believe, 300 kilos of enriched uranium, and now it was going to be zero, as you said, that they couldn't hold on to any of it. And this, I think, goes back to what you were saying, Emma, about the fact that you had Kushner and Witkoff looking for that, you know, specific, the zero enrichment phrase.
Right.
And it's like, basically, they'd agreed to that. They'd agreed to zero stockpiling. And so there's no capacity that, you know, they simply cannot make a weapon. And that Trump could have said, I did it. I did the thing. I got the longer, stronger, better deal. You know, I got what Obama couldn't get. And he could have avoided all of this. And the fact that the Omani foreign minister, they don't usually go on media to, right, to try to make this case, because clearly Witkoff and Kushner weren't really getting it. The fact that there was a viable deal here and that the Iranians had crossed their own red line to get there. And instead, we have Trump launching these attacks anyway, and specifically, again, whether it was and the Israelis or the Americans, but hitting a girls' school within the first, you know, the first day of this engagement is horrifying. That, you know, we're already to this point in the conflict where we're, you know, there have already been 10 medical facilities struck, which are supposed to be protected. Obviously, schools are supposed to be protected. Obviously, civilian infrastructure in general is not a legitimate military target. And yet already we're seeing the both. And again, it's hard to tell sometimes whether it's an Israeli missile or an American missile or who launched it, but targeting the civilian infrastructure in ways that are very reminiscent of Gaza.
Yes. Yes. And to bolster this point, though, about Witkoff, like there was reporting a few months ago that Witkoff didn't understand Putin and or the Russian-Ukraine land swap offer, that Reuters had reported that it seems like, I don't know, statecraft, you're at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, but statecraft should be a thing. Diplomacy is a thing. And just sticking your real estate buddy in and your son-in-law in to negotiate these deals means like they seem to misunderstand basic tenets of what the negotiations entail.
Exactly. And, you know, you think about like when under the very, you know, painstaking negotiations to get to Obama's nuclear deal, they had nuclear scientists there to sort of hash out the specifics, people whose life is dedicated to understanding these issues and could agree on the very specific terms. Whereas, yeah, here it seemed maybe like they did control F for zero enrichment. And since it wasn't in there, they're like, no.
Yeah.
Well, they also did stay at a Holiday Inn. Express the night beat. I'm sorry. Oh. but let me ask you this, though. Is it possible that they did understand what was being offered? They had chased the car. They caught the car. And at that point, they were like, we're not getting enough resistance from the Iranians. We got to do this now.
I think that is entirely plausible as well, that you had Trump had made the decision that he wanted to move forward with this. And so negotiations really were just a ploy. Emma, kind of as you were saying, that America's credibility as a negotiator has been significantly eroded, not only in the eyes of Iran, but in any other country trying to negotiate with them. And as you pointed out, that is directly in the interest of Netanyahu, who doesn't want this to end in negotiations. He doesn't want an off-ramp. He wants the U.S. to continue to use up our limited interceptors. I mean, that's also a crucial component of this, is America's supply of these very expensive missile interceptors has been significantly reduced by the war in Ukraine, as well as the 12-day war last summer. And we don't have the capacity, which is why, as we were saying earlier, the U.S. is focusing its attention on defending Israel and not on defending these other Gulf partners, which, Emma, as you pointed out, are very, you know, they're looking for other alternatives. We saw after the strike on Doha in September, within 8 days, Saudi Arabia signed the defense treaty with Pakistan, a nuclear-armed state. There's been talk that they'll also sign something similar with Turkey, maybe also Egypt. And so sort of developing this alternative middle power, I mean, Turkey is a NATO member, but But these countries are understandably going to be looking elsewhere because the United States, whether it's on the security front or, you know, more broadly, just, sorry, I'm a little all over the place, but just, you know, Trump's announcement just now that he's going to cut off dealings with Spain because they said that they're going, and dealings, I assume like trade, you know, cut off the relationship with Spain because they're not going to allow the U.S. to launch attacks on Iran from Spanish territory. I mean, you know, it's just like the whole world is like, wow, it would maybe have been a little foolish for us to have relied on the United States behaving somewhat sanely, whether in the economic realm or the security realm. Maybe it's time to restructure our global order in a way that doesn't depend on there being somebody sane and competent in the White House.
That would be the most rational reaction to this, frankly. Sheline, research fellow at the Middle East program at Quincy Institute. Thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks, Anil.
All right, we're going to take a quick break and we'll come back. Seamus Malakafzali will be joining us, freelance journalist, co-host of the Turbulence Pod, publisher of his new newsletter at SeamusMalakafzali.com. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Seder, Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report. Pleasure to welcome to the program Seamus Malakafzali, freelance journalist, co-host of the Turbulence Pod and publisher of his own newsletter under his name at Substack. Seamus, welcome to the program.
Happy to be on.
So we were just talking to Anil Sheline from the Quincy Institute about sort of like the mystery of why America did this and what Netanyahu is hoping to gain out of this. Give us your perspective of sort of the regional reaction and to the extent that there is both surprise in what the U.S. has done and the surprise in which if they have any in Iran's reaction and the U.S.'s inability to protect them from Iran's reaction.
In the Gulf, there, I have not seen very much in the way of criticizing the United States, at least for now. They are mostly concerned with shooting down Iranian drones, Iranian ballistic missiles. But this is something that the Gulf states have been warning Trump about. They had previously intervened in order to stop a potential strike back in January because of the threat of that retaliation. And apparently Trump did not consider this to be a real possibility, nor did I think a lot of people in the administration. Right now, I think they are limiting their strong reactions to Iran solely just because right now self-defenses, as in the Patriot missiles that are shooting down these missiles and drones, they are reliant on U.S. supply. They cannot do a unilateral retaliation if they wanted to do that against Iran without significant American support. I think they're trying to treat this as delicately as they possibly can.
What do you make of, we heard the statement from Rubio, and it's also Mike Johnson has said the same thing. Like, we had to strike because we knew Israel was going to strike, and we knew that if Israel struck, then Iran would strike us. And so we needed to strike them first so that as to minimize the casualties for us if they struck, which, okay, take that at face value. But Trump also said that he was surprised that Iran struck these various countries in the region, American bases for the most part, although some, it's, you know, like, I guess maybe airports, but ones that were affiliated, you know, next to. So what ostensibly did, when Rubio says they would strike us, did, like, is he saying that they thought that Iran would send missiles to America? Like, I don't understand. How can you be both surprised and anticipate Iranian retaliation?
I don't think Trump on a personal level understands anything that is happening or knows about what's happening or has any idea of what comes later. On the issue of like leadership for Iran, he seems to oscillate between hearing that there is a temporary council of three people and those are three choices. But then those choices got killed, but didn't really get killed. And now there may be moderate elements, but he doesn't know what those moderate elements are. I think he personally is just hearing things in his briefing and he remembers bits and pieces of it. And then he just says it to the press. As for Rubio and Mike Johnson, these are people with functioning minds. And I think this is mostly deception. Dropsite, I believe, was reporting on this, that the date for this, for these strikes was decided weeks in advance. And that the negotiating process was intended, deliberately intended to fail. They expected this to happen. But Trump himself, I think, has been pretty much not present here.
Okay, what do the Iranians fear here more? I mean, I would imagine that because, as Sam's been saying, you know, the state is so... it's more institutionalized than other countries that the United States has tried to wage offensive wars against. I mean, it seems like they're prepared to take a significant amount of damage more than basically capitulating. And that's been the case for decades. I don't see why this would change just because they take out Khomeini.
No, there is a fundamental misunderstanding of the nature of the Islamic Republic by most Republicans, and I also think most Democrats. There is the expectation that because Ali Khamenei was the supreme leader for such a long time, that all the power was vested in him, and that as soon as you took him out, then democracy would flourish and the protesters would rush in and everything would be hunky-dory from there. But when Khomeini died, the Republic did not fall. They were able to simply elect a new one. And that appears to be the case here. No, they're really hoping that a Venezuela situation could happen here, in which a much less institutionalized country, to borrow the language that you're using, they see one of their top leaders, their top leader, get taken out, and the rest of them fall in line because they fear death. They fear being taken out of the picture one way or another. In Iran, there are multiple different institutional structures that would fight against that. And also there is just no chance. I hate to rely on polemicism, but there is really no chance that they are just going to give in on this and acquiesce to American demands. That there is no way that the political system will allow for that in any strong way. It is a managed democracy, but there have always been political winds inside the country pushing their heels in against American influence.
For the past 20 years, anyone I've interviewed about Iran has more or less said the same thing, that there are wide... deep institutions that are structural. And so if that's the case, yeah, just to get back to and I want to come back to what you think broadly Iranian reaction will be. But if that is the case, and Rubio has a functioning brain and Lindsey Graham has a functioning brain and Netanyahu theoretically has a functioning brain, like, what do they expect to happen? Like, I guess, I can understand that Netanyahu has no problem with a redux of the Iraq war for America. It didn't really in any way harm Israel. If anything, it strengthened Israel.
He was happy about it.
And And I could see how he'd be like, that would be great if America was here and fighting a 10-year war in Iran. It's no skin off our back. But what does like Rubio or Graham expect to happen? Like, what do they think the outcome that is going to be positive here for them to have done?
The positive result they hope to see is state collapse and civil war. The idea, like Reza Pahlavi, the son of the late Shah, is clearly trying to angle for a strong Iranian ally of the U.S. and Israel, talking about the Cyrus Accords. He was on Fox News with Bart Aromo talking about there being a $1 trillion market opening for the Americans if they invest in Iran and invest in regime change. But I think Lindsey Graham was the one who said this. He doesn't care if there's another cleric or a representative democracy. He cares that Iran is no longer a threat. And that means that Iran needs to be neutralized in its entirety as a force that can project against America. I think those were Hegseth's words. So when Steve Witkoff, who said to Sean Hannity last night that he asked Iran to dismantle its own navy in negotiations, that is not something that I assume he expects to reconstitute under Reza Pahlavi or any pro-democracy leader. The expectation is that it no longer exists permanently, so that America continues to have freedom of operation in the Strait of Hormuz in the Persian Gulf. If Iran is constantly tied up fighting Kurdish separatist groups or Balochi separatist groups or whichever ethnic group, then it has no opportunity to focus on projecting against the West or forming its own foreign policy objectives or projecting influence anywhere. It becomes America and Israel's ball game entirely.
And I think that's also why Netanyahu is in favor of really anything that entangles the United States in the Middle East once again, is that it increases our reliance on Israeli intelligence. My camera's being a little funky. Sorry about that, folks. But it increases our reliance on Israeli intelligence. It entangles the United States even further in that relationship and makes it so that it's less likely that the growing political winds at home are going to shift in the direction of, say, an arms embargo, which I think, like, we've been dancing around the timing of this. But the fact that this is happening as you have Republican members resigning from the House, and as the midterms are coming up, and you have even centrists like Mark Warner who are speaking about Israel's dragging us into this war, like, they feel that they basically have a 9-month, year-long period to wage this war before the tide of American public opinion might impact them. And they're also, by the way, bombing Lebanon, we should say. Like, the Israel's done everything it can to make the region destabilized outside, but the country that they need U.S. support for, because the Iranian missiles can impact them, is the U.S. I mean, they need U.S. support, I should say, if they're going to take action against Iran directly.
Israel knows that it's still, I mean, Israel enjoys so much support from the United States. That's putting it lightly. It wants to be in a position in which it is not reliant on U.S. support in the future. Netanyahu had said that in 10 years, it wants to be free of any sort of American military aid. But conversely, it also wants America to be, as you said, completely tied up in this, completely reliant on Israeli intelligence, Israeli leadership, aligned with Israeli objectives and Israeli strategy. Yep. But if anyone in the government pulls back or wants to pull back, then they have no ability to control Israel. That is the ideal situation that they want to get to, Netanyahu specifically.
What do you make of Oman's foreign minister saying that Iran had agreed to not stockpile enriched uranium, and just, having enriched uranium itself gets diminished as you use it in a nuclear reactor for power. Iran has always wanted to control their own power because obviously you want to be able to generate your own power as a country. If you agree not to stockpile it, you can't build a nuclear weapon. And What do you make of the timing relative to Iran having just offered that? This is according to the foreign minister from Oman.
I mean, there had been that report, as I said before, that this date was entrenched weeks ago, I guess on the eve of Purim, because they are using that symbology. But your intuition is correct that they wanted to head off some sort of conundrum where Iran is clearly offering things in public, but they keep having to say that Iran is in fact digging in its heels and not giving them anything, and they have to be stopped.
This is what happened with Iraq. I mean, yeah. We had weapons inspectors on the ground. They were not finding anything. We were hearing more and more. The weapons inspectors are going to the U.S., to the CIA. Tell us where they are, because we're looking where you told us, and they're not there. And that's when I think the U.S. realized, like, okay, pull them out, because we've got to go in now. It's just going to – we're going to lose the PR battle. In this instance, like, it doesn't even seem like they were waging a PR battle. They just said, we're just going to do it. We don't need to give justification. We're just going to create these facts on the ground. You mentioned, like, the possibility of there being – I mean, there are many different, ethnicities – factions, you could say, in Iran. How, if there was a, and I imagine there are, you know, we have had, whether Israeli or U.S. or British, I mean, whomever, trying to agitate these things, funneling weapons in certain instances, funneling cash, whatever. Is there any way to see any indication of if those efforts are, like, what's happening with those efforts?
Apparently, there was a story, I believe, in the New York Times that Trump had met with Kurdish leaders in Iraq yesterday. He had talked with Masoud Barzani, and the name escapes me, but I believe the leader of the PUK in Iraq. There was already a Kurdish coalition that had been formed shortly before the war broke out between numerous different Iranian Kurdish factions, one of which used to be allied with Reza Pahlavi, but now has obviously gone against him in this regard. They are preparing for this. There are factions within that coalition that have openly sought out Israeli support. They are actively courting that in public. And they want that because they know it is instrumental. It is fundamental to their success, whatever that might be.
Can you just shed some light a little bit on how the IRGC operates without the Supreme Leader at this point? What is the chain of command, is your understanding? And does that have an impact on, like, say, the discipline of the response?
Iran has focused a lot on decentralization of its military. I think they call it the Mosaic Defense Strategy, which allows it, like, the defense minister was killed, the commander-in-chief of the armed forces was killed, numerous other military officials. Trump obviously says something like 40-something, but he has not released names in that regard. It has allowed it that local commanders, regional commanders, still operate completely functionally because of prior instructions about what to do. And that has meant that the ladder of escalation continues to be climbed without the defense minister authorizing it, without the commander-in-chief of the IRGC authorizing it. So that means that they are authorized technically to strike Oman, to potentially have struck Riyadh, the U.S. embassy in Riyadh, without the Iranian government authorizing it, and in some cases directly saying that they did not authorize it and they would not have authorized it. That has allowed them to control the ladder of escalation better than, say, Hezbollah would have been able to, had been able to.
Well, Hezbollah is relevant here because the Hezbollah has been severely weakened by the decapitation strikes that Israel has engaged in over the past 2.5 years of genocide and also, you know, illegal bombing campaigns in other countries. But there seems to be a really concerted effort by the Israelis to conceal how much damage Iranian missiles have caused. We've also touched on this throughout our conversation, but I'm curious about your thoughts on that front, and why that's the case, how that's happened, and what the capacity is for Iranian weaponry to actually inflict damage on Israel.
What happened during the last war was that Iran hit numerous buildings related to the Israeli Defense Ministry and the Mossad. It achieved direct hits on these places. It was not an overwhelming show of force like Israel was able to do so, or as America is doing so now. But it clearly showed, one, the ability for Iran to circumvent Israeli air defenses when Israel had been claiming that 99% of drones and missiles were being intercepted at one point or another, but also that it had intelligence about where these places were. More than Israel would want to admit. I have not been able, I mean, again, the military censorship regime prevents me from making any sort of assumptions about the current situation, but they are very adamant about that not happening again. There have already been instructions sent to the Israeli public not to film sites where Iranian missiles are located. I believe Turkish journalists were just arrested on camera just a few hours before this because they have been filming. And we also remember last year when Trey Yingst, the Fox News cameraman, was trying to film the Kyria having been attacked by Iran, and the IDF yes. immediately descended on his position. There has to be a complete shield around the aura of Israel's invincibility, and that has to be maintained because otherwise, people lose faith in that. They can utilize scenes of mass devastation in places like Tel Aviv or Beit Shemesh when that is useful, but it cannot be constant. It cannot be.
Mearsheimer talks about this as escalation dominance, and that being kind of, you know, Israel's the part of their kind of the psychological element of their warfare is the trying to maintain this idea that, like, the Iron Dome and their missile defense and their weapon systems are so advanced and sophisticated that you should not strike against them. But it's important to note that contradicts their actions, and their fear of Iran is contradicted by their open fear of Iran's capabilities.
Yes. I mean, it's both that Israel has the ability to intercept everything, but also Iran holds not only the existential threat to Israel through its ballistic missile capabilities, and that one day Netanyahu was on Hannity last night and said that in a couple months, it would be impossible to stop the nuclear program, even with Israeli weaponry. But also that Iran doesn't just threaten Israel, doesn't just threaten Europe, but it threatens the entire Earth. I remember the IDF posted a video during the last war where they had a bunch of flags wave on screen about what countries Israel could threaten. And one of them was China. Like, the whole of China is apparently a threat that is in Iran's crosshairs. It's not based in any sort of reality. You have to signal that you are both invincible but also incredibly vulnerable. And it is not. It's a very schizophrenic position.
When you look at, are there signs that you look for that give an indication of where this is going? In other words, if the number of interceptors is diminished, and you start to see Iranian drones or missiles hit certain places that should not be possible based upon interceptors, or if there are more U.S. ships or less U.S. ships moving in. I mean, what would be indicators of where this is going? Because, I mean, I guess, like, on some level, it's very difficult to predict what the U.S. is going to do because we have a mad king who, it seems to me, it's just as possible he wakes up tomorrow morning and Laura Loomer says something that annoys him and he's like, we're done. We won and we're done and, you know, we're going back. Or, you know, Laura Loomer sends him a muffin basket and he's like, we're boots on the ground. I'm not skittish. But what are other sort of like more tangible things that if we could predict, if it wasn't a monkey playing chess, what would they be?
If we remember after, I think what Trump called Liberation Day, with the tariffs. I mean, he was gung-ho for all of this stuff. But as soon as the market responded poorly, to say the least, then he had to pull back from that. When it's clear that he is screwing with the money, as it were, that is when I think he usually gets the picture. He starts to get calls from people he would most likely not like to get calls from. The Dow apparently plunged 1,000 points today at opening. Oil prices are sky high. They're getting sky high. But what's interesting to me is that Trump is starting to not only dig in his heels rhetorically, in that he said that after this is all over, the oil price is going to go lower than maybe you've ever heard before. But apparently there are moves being made to force tankers transiting the Strait of Hormuz to get them insurance because insurers are dropping them.
Yes.
I think there is an attempt here. He wants an off-ramp, obviously. He wants to get this done in a matter of days, like was the case in Venezuela. But I think the 4 or 5 week thing is probably going to be the general timeline. When the 12-day war happened, there was a bottleneck approaching near the end of that conflict with Israel, where Israel was running out and there was going to be significant restrictions on their part. Now, America obviously has the USS Gerald Ford there to intercept things. It is apparently bringing in more interceptor batteries from the Asian theater, which I find incredible. I don't think the bottleneck will come as quickly, but it is going to approach. And I'm guessing that that 4 or 5 week window was what was given because of that, that is when things are going to get nasty for the Americans.
So in other words, we have interceptors that will last for 4 or 5 weeks.
That is my assumption. It could come earlier if Iran continues to throw drones at the Gulf at the rate that it has. Right. But Iran does not have, it has an immense domestic capability, but it does not have infinite domestic capability. It will inevitably have to cut the rate at which it fires things, which will give America potentially time to move in things and extend that timeline. But I won't say anything for certain because we are truly in uncharted territory here with the kind of assets that are being brought in.
And this is where Venezuela, it's important to put it in that context when we're trying to understand Trump's motivation here, obviously, is because, I mean, it seems like he was willing, because he was on this high, really willing to accept these pie in the sky assumptions about how quickly he could both like topple the regime, but then maybe even do what he said with Venezuela, which is just take the oil. You know, is he deluded enough to think that he can seize the oil? And that's when he says things like oil prices are going to be going down to record lows, because he views this as another way to for conquest. And that we're essentially just going to be taking over their reserves or their oil fields quite quickly.
He hasn't said that explicitly yet, which I am almost surprised by. He has mostly focused on eliminating missile capabilities in Navy, but I am sure that that will come into the discussion soon if this becomes drawn out and costly. When America needs to justify to the public that it will be getting something out of this arrangement other than simply waging a war primarily for Israeli interests. That entered the equation in Venezuela, as you said. It's going to enter the conversation with Cuba. It entered the conversation with Ukraine. It's a matter of time, I think, with him, even if he is moving towards state collapse with Iran.
I guess we'll see. It's going to be interesting to see if, he's an old guy. If he passes away in the next 6 weeks, how many people go like, I didn't want to do this, but he insisted.
Well, if he is assassinated by Iran, we can just take comfort in knowing that it's not an act of war. Because
it's just how the world works.
Did I break Seamus?
I can't.
This is not Seamus doesn't want to be part of this conversation.
It's a joke.
I know. Is anyone listening? It's a joke.
Yes,
of course. I mean, but there, you know, a precedent has been set.
It's not an act of war.
It's obviously illegal, but it's not an act of war.
And Iran should be able to bomb our facilities as well, and we should not be able to punch back. So precedent set.
Well, they would have only done that so that to prevent us from punching back after somebody else did it.
Yep.
So,
deniably.
Yeah, exactly. Seamus Malik Hafzali, thank you so much for your time today. We will put a link to your newsletter at majority.fm and our podcast and YouTube, as well as a link to the Turbulence Pod. I suspect you're going to have a lot to talk about over the next, couple of weeks or 10 years. So
indeed.
Thanks so much for coming on.
Appreciate it.
Thanks, Seamus.
All right, folks. We're going to take a break and head to the fun half of the program. I mean, who knows?
Doing the dance, the car roll dance. Doing the dance, the car roll dance.
Oh, my God. We're all doing
the car rove dance today, folks.
You got to go back in the archives. Like, the neocons are, you know, they're back. They never left us, but they're back. And so we need some Bush era kind of reminiscing if we're going to be doing this.
I was going to mention to him. I was going to mention to him the idea of someone like Lindsey Graham or Rubio, for that matter, or Netanyahu being okay with a balkanized Iran. With multiple warring factions is a mini version of what the Project for New American Century document was that was written in the wake of the first Iraq war by folks like Dick Cheney and Pearl and Wolfowitz, I think, was in writing, and Feist. Was Doug Feist, I think it was his name. These names I haven't said in, 15 years. And the Project for New American Century was the contemplation by the neocons that America could become a hyperpower and that the rest of the world would be in. What would happen is there would be no other superpower to contest with us. We would be a hyperpower that would oversee a world with a bunch of regional conflicts. And those regional conflicts would be both containable, but also serve to prevent any type of coalition or buildup of power that would challenge us.
Mm-hmm.
And we would have a somewhat pox, but totally Americana in terms of over the entire globe by having that hegemony that was enhanced by low-level conflicts. And so the idea of a balkanized Iran that would be helpful to Israel just means, like, nobody can coalesce and deal with our power.
Iran plays a pretty key part in China's Belt and Road Initiative.
I mean, all of the Middle East. I mean, I was also quite convinced that much of Iraq was founded in a concern that China would get hegemony or creep into, we would lose hegemony over the oil. And
yes.
It wasn't so much that we would just get it cheaply, but rather we would control the spigot. And
that's, I mean, why.
And of course, China then goes and says, like, oh, well, we're going to do solar and all our cars are going to be electric.
Yeah,
so
we have options.
I mean, that's why it's important to mention that that report about the Gulf states getting stonewalled by the United States. If they're going to experience the blowback, but not the benefit, this is mandate from heaven for Xi Jinping.
I got to say, like, being aware of American history and the way of the American colonists played different tribes against each other and eventually came for all of them, I would just say that when Dave Rubin says you're all Muslims and he doesn't know why Iran would attack
Arabs.
Other Muslims,
yeah.
Like, that's where you're all on the menu, folks.
Right,
so you should figure out how to get out from under America, because we're not going to treat you any better.
Dorsey reminds me, it was Douglas Feith, who Spain also wanted to investigate him for war crimes. Spain was quite good in the whole war crime thing. I think they got pretty far down the road with Dick Cheney because of the way that they have their prosecutors. But he escaped by dying. That's it for us today, at least for the free show. We're going to head into the fun half, and boy, is it going to be fun.
Oh, yeah.
You're going to hear more from folks Mike Johnson. Oh, yes. There's a lot of third way stuff. Oh, here's the other thing I wanted to mention. We're not quite in Iraq war territory in terms of our attack on Iran. We may or may not get there. But the thing I learned from going through those 4 or 5 years, those first 4 or 5 years, well, 6 years, I guess, of that war, is that during that time, there was enough insight by people I did not like Rahm Emanuel, let's say, and those forces within the Democratic Party to understand that someday the Democrats would be back in power. And they prepared. And that's been going on through the Trump years, even through the Biden years. And the difference is this time is that it's not just been happening with the third way types. It's been happening with the folks to the left of the Democratic Party who want to pull the Democratic Party left. DSA, Justice Democrats, however you want to, place that ideologically. And so Bernie Sanders came out with a proposal yesterday for a wealth tax. And, you know, it occurred to me that, like, if something like this had been proposed during the beginning of the Iraq War, I'd be like, there's no time to talk about this. But this is a very important time to talk about it, because Donald Trump is not going to be president forever. He may not even be alive for the rest of his term. Who knows? He's got a huge rash on his neck. And who knows what that is?
It's all I know is it's gross.
It's called the winning rash.
Oh, yeah.
My understanding is there are flesh-eating bacteria that exist in the world. So it could be anything. It could just be eczema. Bernie Sanders introducing a wealth tax. It would be 5% annually on billionaires. It would raise about $4.4 trillion. He has a list of things on how to spend that $4.3 trillion. So it would be deficit positive. In other words, it would shrink the deficit. So you could say that, but, you know, by $1 billion. But the point that this is going to serve as, or could, is very much like Medicare for All did in various campaigns, and does today. Like, every candidate that we talked to yesterday, and I would say almost like, you know, the number of candidates who it's non-controversial, we need Medicare for All at this point, is astounding relative to the way it would have been 10, 12 years ago.
Yeah.
And it's a litmus test, and it's a shorthand, and it's a not necessarily a purity test, but it is a litmus test. Are you, you know, it is a shorthand. This person can be supported in many respects. And I think that the reason why Sanders is introducing this now is as we go forward into the midterms, and we're getting closer in many respects to things like, primaries, obviously a big primary today in North Carolina from a congressional standpoint. The trillionaire tax becomes a way in which people can ask candidates and get a sense of where they're located in this battle between money. We'll talk more about this as we talk about these third way clips, but this is a very important piece of legislation, regardless of whether you think it can happen or not. It is a way of ideologically defining yourself as to the question of a wealth tax is definitive in the same way that a single payer healthcare system is. It is basically saying that, you know what, we do not want a society where people can accumulate so much money that they function as royalty in a system where royalty actually gets to make the rules. So we'll talk more about that. But in the meantime, this show relies on its members to keep on keeping on.
Mm-hmm.
And you can help this show survive and thrive by becoming a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you not only get the free show free of commercials, but you also get to IM us on the and the fun half. We'll take phone calls today, I think, even.
Whoa.
Yes. Also, justcoffee.coop. It's a co-op. It's in Madison, Wisconsin. They make great coffee. They make a Majority Report blend. And they'll give you 10% off if you use the coupon code MAJORITY, our longest sponsor on this program. Actually predates this program. And I'm curious how?
No.
Okay. Matt, what's happening in the Matt Lechmy universe?
Yeah, we've been doing a lot on Iran for the Sunday show. I did a solo show talking about Iran and what Charlie Kirk would have wanted, which is to celebrate last year how Lindsey Graham is definitely not going to get what he wants. What a difference a year makes. And today, after the show, we're going to have Gene Bajelon, a TMBS original guest, on talking about Iran, and also someone named Anel Scheline talking about Iran as well. So a lot of Iran stuff today coming up right after the show, right after the fun half.
That was a happy coincidence, by the way. But yes, oh, I have to plug, if you are in LA in a few weeks, March 22nd, I'm going to be at Dynasty Typewriter with Francesca Fiorentini, Van Lathan, Ida Rodriguez. Great, great, great lineup. Link down below. March 22nd, it's a matinee. It's going
to
be really fun.
And people are going to be able to party and go to things in LA because it's so far from Iran that the ballistic missiles won't be able to, intercontinental missiles that Iran has will not be able to get to California, right? I mean,
well,
thanks to Trump.
Are we closer on the East Coast?
I don't know.
To Iran?
As the crow flies?
Yeah, I think by great phrase. You go over the North Pole, I think we're probably closer.
Probably. Yeah.
Okay. So you're out there, people are going to be partying in here.
Right, right. I'm hopefully escaping. Yeah.
It's like London in the Blitz, where Iran's looking at
nuclear wasteland. And then also, I guess, check out my episode of Doom Scroll if you haven't already.
Folks, see you in the fun half. 3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now, and I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now, and I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now, but I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow.
What?
What is that going on? It's nuts. Wait a second. Hold on for a second. Emma, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Matt!
What is up, everyone?
Fun hack. Nomi Key.
You did it!
Fun
hack. Let's go, Brandon.
Let's go, Brandon.
Fun hack. Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today.
Fundamentally false.
No, I'm sorry. Women's...
Stop talking for a second. And let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But, dude, you want to smoke this...
7A. Yes.
Hi, is this me?
Is it?
Yes. Is
this
me?
Is it me?
It is you.
Is this me? Hello, is this me?
I think it is you. Who is you? No sound. Every single freaking day. What's on your mind?
Sports. We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
Oh, I'm going to go throw up.
You libertarians.
They're so stupid, though. Common sense says, of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed him.
So what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge met.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I want to say. 857-210-3501. One half. 3/8.
9/11, for instance.
$3,400. $1,900.
$5.43 trillion. Sold. It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less.
But let me say this.
Poop.
You call it satire. Sam goes with satire.
On top of it all, my favorite part about you is just like every day, all day, like everything you do.
Without a doubt. Hey, buddy, we see you. All right, folks.
It's just the week being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, sun's out, guns out. I don't know.
But you should know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
Our chat is enabled,
wow.
Folks.
Love it.
I do love that.
Look, gotta jump. Gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock. We're already late, and the guy's being a dick. So screw him. Sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you. Bye.
Love you. Bye-bye.
We are back. Sam Cedar, Emma Vigeland on the fun half. Special Edward, are you guys going to talk about the fact that some American military commanders are telling troops that the war in Iran is all part of God's plan? What the serious F? Oh, yeah. Jonathan Larson reported that out. I am not surprised. You go back to the Iraq War. There was a famous Air Force general who was in front of a stage talking about how our God is better than their God, and that's why we're going to win. And
Pete Hegseth said something similar to that yesterday when he said that something like no people who believe in like Islamist prophets should be allowed to have a nuclear weapon.
Well, he has a Crusades tattoo, yeah. Which means he's pretty cool with the idea of killing Muslims.
Yeah.
It's, you know, the
should be purges. I mean, Hitchens wrote an essay about this in the Iraq War, and that was the one thing he had critical about the military during that time, is too many Christian fundamentalists. They should not be allowed in leadership roles. It's insane.
The West will pretend like Muslim people are the only people motivated by religion to pursue bloodshed. But of course, this is just a racist mythology that obscures, the Christian nationalism that drives so many of the neocons and the Republicans.
How can you say that, Emma? We have such a wonderful Christian leader, Speaker of the House. He is such a God-fearing man that even he has asked his son to monitor his use of his cell phone so that because it had a problem with its operating system that it kept downloading Grindr.
Yeah, and he's got to be on. He must have been on call, his son, yesterday and the day before, because the idea of all of those Iranian schoolgirls being burned to death and bombed to death by U.S. weapons must have had Mike Johnson horny as hell.
Well, it's true. There are other things also that maybe he might use to relieve. But nevertheless, here is Mike Johnson trying to explain that the bombing of Iran by the United States and Israel, without provocation, incidentally, the assassination of Iran's leaders, without provocation, incidentally, was defensive.
To me, the most critical point is that this was a defensive measure, a defensive operation. And why is that? I took some notes, and this is not classified, so I'll tell you what I think is important. Israel was determined to act in their own defense here, with or without American support. Why? Because Israel faced what they deemed to be an existential threat. Iran was building missiles at a radical and a rapid clip. To the point where our allies in the region could not keep up. As you know, Iran has long vowed to take out Israel, wipe it off the map, and they have long seen that as a critical threat to their very existence. Because Israel was determined to act, with or without the U.S., our commander-in-chief and the administration and the officials I just named had a very difficult decision to make. They had to evaluate the threats to the U.S., to our troops, to our installations, to our assets in the region and beyond. And they determined, because of the exquisite intelligence that we had, that if Israel fired upon Iran and took action against Iran to take out the missiles, then they would have immediately retaliated against U.S. personnel and assets. We have troops in harm's way, and we have many Americans in the region, and that was of a great concern. If we had waited for all of those eventualities to take place, the consequences of inaction on our part would have been, could have been devastating. We don't know at what magnitude, but you can assume, because it is common sense, that if Iran had begun to fire all of their missile arsenal, short and mid-range missiles, at our personnel and our assets and our installations, we would have suffered staggering losses. And if we had waited to respond before acting first, then the, those losses would have been far greater than if we had done what we did.
Common sense.
He looks flushed, too.
Okay.
It's got redder and redder.
First off, he's getting excited.
First off, just even taking the most basic assertion, there is no reason to believe that if we were aware that Israel was going to strike, that we would be any less prepared for an Iranian counterstrike than if we had struck first. We in no way diminished their capacity to return fire. So that part of the lie is a lie. Then, of course, there's the part of like, oh, we have no control over Israel. We just have to follow what they do. And
because and they were prepared to attack
we had
alone?
To do it. It was the only way we could be defensive because Israel was going to put us in harm's way. But not, well, I'm not really saying that, but yeah, that's what we're saying. So, I mean, obviously all of that's a lie. But the best part is that after Rubio says this, and after Mike Johnson says this, everybody goes, oh, wait a second. Are you saying that the Israel dictates our, not just foreign policy, but what we do in terms of wartime? Is that really the case? And unfortunately, somebody heard, Donald Trump heard somebody say that on the TV. And so here he goes, within hours, sitting with the, is this with the German chancellor? He throws Johnson and Rubio under the proverbial bus.
Mr. President, did Israel force your hand to launch these strikes against Iran? Did that
No.
help the United States?
No, I might have forced their hand. You see, we were having negotiations with these lunatics, and it was my opinion that they were going to attack first. They were going to attack if we didn't do it. They were going to attack first. I felt strongly about that. And we have great negotiators, great people, people that do this very successfully and have done it all their lives very successful. And based on the way the negotiation was going, I think they were going to attack first. And I didn't want that to happen. So if anything, I might have forced Israel's hand.
Oh.
Israel was ready and we were ready.
I have the
we've had a very, very powerful impact because virtually everything they have has been knocked out now.
Okay, so now Iran was doing the negotiations with America just to put us to sleep so that they could attack us.
It almost sounds like exactly what you did, by the way.
And
what the U.S. did, but negotiating with Iran to lull them into a false sense of security bombing them.
We got the sense that they were trying to hoodwink us. So I forced Israel to attack Iran, and that's what I did. Now, why did they have to do it? Well, they had to do it because I told them to do it. And in fact, not only that, not only does Israel not tell me what to do, I tell Israel what to do. Here is Bibi. I told Bibi, go on Sean Hannity and tell everybody that I told you to attack Iran after I attacked Iran.
This was last night, and Trump had tweeted out, like, in all caps, don't miss it. And I saw Jacob Kornblatt I forget which paper, publication, just said that he was acting like basically the PR person for Benjamin Netanyahu. So he was watching this interview.
Oh,
and I'd imagine that it wasn't just Mike Johnson and Rubio coming out and admitting basically that Israel dragged us into this and making Trump look like a cuck to Netanyahu, which he is, publicly. It was also this appearance last night where Netanyahu was basically laughing at the rest of us.
Well, also, I wanted to say this. Rubio and Johnson when they came out and said that we had to attack because Israel was going to, and it would have left us vulnerable, and so we just followed Israel's lead, they were basically walking us on a leash. They weren't freelancing. They didn't come up with this on their own.
No.
They were told this by the White House. And then when Trump hears how it plays, he goes, no, actually, it's the opposite. I forced Israel to do it, and I'll prove it by telling Sean Hannity to have Netanyahu on later tonight.
Fair enough.
What are your thoughts?
Well, you're right. I did have spoken about it for decades, and I try to persuade...
A lifetime worth of study, in my view. And I want to ask you this. You know, there are people that say, well, the prime minister of Israel dragged Donald Trump into it. And as somebody that's been friends with him over 30 years, nobody drags Donald Trump into anything, number one. But I want to get your reaction to that.
looking and sound. Oh, pause it. I mean, look.
Holy Dracula.
God.
Sean, give me 1 second so I could look as evil and as completely disingenuous as possible. Allow me to fake laugh.
So some people called me the Hitler of the 21st century.
Oh, that's laughable, Sean. Did you hear me?
But I want to lean into it.
It's laughable. That's my proof that I laughed. That way, you know, it's laughable. No, he just called me. Good.
Trump into it. And as somebody that's been friends with him over 30 years, nobody drags Donald Trump into anything, number one. But I want to get your reaction to that.
Bond villain.
You're right. I mean, that's ridiculous. Donald Trump is the strongest leader in the world. He does what he thinks is right for America.
That's right.
He does also what he thinks is right for future generations. And frankly, we're partners in that effort because I've devoted my life to securing the life of the one and only Jewish state. And believe me, it's been a struggle. I've known the pangs of war. I lost a brother in war and in battle. I myself fought terrorists and was wounded in liberating hostages from a hijacked plane. I held a fellow soldier in my arms when I was 18, and he died in my arms. I know the cost of war, but I know sometimes that war is necessary to protect us from the people who would destroy us. And that's what free societies have to understand.
Trump's like, I also had an 18-year-old die in my arms.
Oh, yes. He looks ill. I mean, I think, you know, the time doesn't go on forever for everybody, for anybody, really, for that matter. And that's the kind of answer you give when you're like, I've got 6 weeks, and this may be the last time I'm on Hannity.
Hopefully.
But I've gotten everything I've always prayed for. The bombing of innocent civilians in Iran. And so I'm happy. I go out a happy man.
The way that he laughs like this is the man that every time he comes to Washington brings his laundry with him because he thinks that it's really funny that to have the Americans do his laundry. And why would he think that? Because he likes the display of the Israelis being the ones controlling American foreign policy. And so that's why he laughs there. It's because he knows that he's basically just trying to appeal to Trump's ego, when in reality, like the Israelis do, of course, love the idea of them being the ones that are the tails wagging the dog, for lack of a better phrase.
But what's stunning about this is how quickly their primary, I mean, you had the Secretary of State and the Speaker of the House come out and give justification for this attack on Iran. And within hours, they were certainly told to do so by the White House. Within hours, Trump decided, no, actually, it's the opposite. And he gets Netanyahu to go on with Hannity. I mean, that entire interview was for that exchange.
Exactly.
And, you know, we know Sean Hannity works for the White House.
Also, a neocon who's been coming out and criticizing his former colleague Tucker Carlson for his criticisms of Israel. So, I mean, Hannity is on board here to have Netanyahu on to continue to sell the war in Iran to the public.
And when I tell you that this selling of this war is so ham-fisted, so poorly done, so weak relative to what the buildup to Iraq, and this is clip number four. There was a time, like in the buildup to the war on Iraq, the invasion, the occupation, the bombing, shock and awe. The idea that you would say we should not be bombing Iraq, we should not invade Iraq. If there are weapons of mass destruction there, let the weapons inspectors do their jobs. Don't pull them out so that we can bomb the place. Let them do their job. You were told by a range of people from Andrew Sullivan. I can't remember if Iglesias actually did this, but Thomas Friedman, and then all the way to the right, that you were a Saddam lover. And the idea that you could hold the idea that Saddam Hussein is a bad person, a bad dictator, bad for the country, Iraq, but that we should not be blowing up this country was impossible to hold that. They're trying to do that again, but they are not sending their best.
No.
These propagandists are the B and C team. Here is Senator Sheehy from, where is he even from? Is he from Montana? What, Montana. Right? I mean, if they got the guy from Montana coming out to do this, they can't find anybody else who's willing to do it.
Mark Wayne Mullen's
number one target.
Mullen was like, all right, 48 hours of being the senator selling this on cable news, I am out. We need this guy.
Get some other yokel up there.
So they send this yokel local up there, and here he is trying to claim that anybody against the bombing of Iran at behest of Israel, and then Trump says, no, Israel did it the behest of me, is an Ayatollah lover.
Wow, Trump. Yeah, no one is saying Iran has been doing good things. I mean, the Iranian leadership. But
well, there's
actually
quite a few Democrats and folks who are defending the Ayatollah's right to continue to rule and defending his existence. So I think
who is defending the Ayatollah?
Well, let's see. We've had Elizabeth Warren's former campaign manager out there literally chanting death to America on stage yesterday.
Cool. I don't know who that is, but Elizabeth Warren is not.
Pause it. Elizabeth Warren's former campaign manager.
Chanting death to America. They've got us dead to rights. And I'm very skeptical of that claim.
I love how Collins goes, I don't know who that is.
How about when America's doing evil stuff, I don't give a fuck. I don't give a single shit that people are saying death to America anywhere in the world when America's being Hitler.
Well, yes, I get you.
I just want to know.
I get you.
So I
but
can go
but
to
we're
that
talking about the Republican propaganda project. Yeah. And when they're out there within 24 hours of this bombing, and the best they can do is talk about Elizabeth Warren's former campaign manager. We don't know from which campaign, incidentally.
Right. And she could, and who knows, Elizabeth Warren could be orchestrating this all together. I mean, she's basically the Ayatollah sleeper cell here in the United States.
It's just, they are not prepared for this, even with the rule. I mean, understand. The mainstream corporate media loves a war. They cannot help themselves. And they want to be able to echo this stuff. But they like you have to give them something. Collins is like, I don't know who that is. So it's a little bit difficult. There was a guy on YouTube I saw who said this. I mean, that's what the level we're at here. I go back a little bit and just watch how lame their propaganda.
Did he not think that he was going to be asked a follow-up question about this?
Things. I mean, the Iranian leadership. But
well,
there's
actually
this
quite
is
a
about
few Democrats and folks who are defending the Ayatollah's right to continue to rule and defending his existence. So I think
who is
fairness,
defending the Ayatollah?
Well, let's see. We've had Elizabeth Warren's former campaign manager out there literally chanting death to America on stage yesterday.
I don't know who that is, but Elizabeth Warren is not defending the Ayatollah. But
Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib, who are saying that this is after the New York Times publishing an obituary describing me as an avuncular cleric.
I think that was the Washington Post. But again, that's not a lawmaker. That's not a Democrat who is saying that this is what they did. But the reason I ask why this is happening is because we hear a bunch of different reasons from the administration. It doesn't seem like there's anyone settled on one reason. I mean, you just said regime change. Secretary Hegseth said this morning it's not a regime change war.
I think the reason you're hearing so many varied reasons is the varied threats this regime presents.
No one is saying Iran has been...
Scroll down to the next one, because there's another clip. Go down. That one right there. Yeah.
It's an image.
Oh, wait. There's another clip in what I sent.
Okay.
Where he had said something completely different a couple of months ago.
Dave Weigel looked into this. He said, I checked with old Warren staff to figure out who he could be talking about, and the consensus is that he must think Calla Walsh, who worked for Markey, not Warren, and was her campaign manager. So he didn't even get that right.
Well, I'm on her Wikipedia. She volunteered for the campaign. She was not a campaign manager for Liz
Yeah, that's...
Campaign volunteer?
Yeah, a campaign
that's
volunteer.
Absurd.
Yes, I mean, but this is the thing, this is what clearly Democratic leadership believes, and it just spills out in those certain circumstances.
Now, wait a second. I just put this in there. That same guy was on CNN in June of 2025. Now, this is a long time ago. It's almost over 8 months ago. Six, seven. Somewhere around there. And here is that same guy explaining to you something radical has changed the past 6 months, apparently.
Do you support regime change in Iran?
Regime change can only come from one place. That's the people of Iran. They have to make that decision. We've learned that the hard way in Iraq and Afghanistan. I was part of both those wars where we chose to change regimes. And guess what? We ended up there in a long time in a war we didn't understand, fighting for something that not all Americans agreed with. So regime change comes from one place. That's the people of Iran making the decision to decide if they want to continue to live under the yoke of a murderous regime, or if they want to overthrow that regime and return to the relative prosperity and freedom that Iran once enjoyed 46 years
ago. So you think the president should rule out regime change in Iran?
Regime change is not our decision. It's not America's
Well, I mean, the president
choice.
Was saying today that they could take him out, that he's safe for now. I mean, he had that caveat there that obviously is not
sure. The president likes to negotiate. The president likes to know that all the weapons are on the table in a negotiation. So, I think he's handling this perfectly. I think he's making it clear, like he has in most of his other negotiations, that anything is on the table. But I think he's also been very clear that he doesn't want to be opening up new fronts of war anywhere, but especially in the Middle East, where we've been, frankly, fighting nonstop for almost half
a century.
Those weapons of mass destruction got to be somewhere. Nope, no weapons over there. Maybe under here.
Yeah. The problem, too, with this Trump giving, like, the timeline about how long this is going to take means that the people of Iran that they're saying need to rise up and, like, cement this regime change are going to need a little bit more time than that. The idea that there's a stop, or there's a like a an expiration date, if we're taking their stated objectives at face value, it means that you're creating like a time limit for this supposed takeover that just puts the protesters in Iran in harm's way.
The idea that I would be an Iranian dissident and I would rely on and trust Trump or Netanyahu to do anything to help me,
yeah,
I think is very, very hard to believe.
There's a significant amount of Kurds in Iran who may have learned that lesson.
They may have. And I think, you know, the point is just that they want to maximize the chaos so that it's very difficult for Iran and to fund Hezbollah, to even, you know, fund Hamas or fund any opposition to Israel. And they see this as like a short time frame where they can do that.
I think this is more about the Strait of Hormuz and the Persian Gulf. I mean, I think this is about making sure that there is no one, there's unfettered threat to shipping through there, and that the U.S. can have control of that to the extent that, like, there are people who even have enough mental capacity to come up with a ridiculous sort of desire or theory. I think Trump, honestly, this is literally like there was more involved when I was playing with army men as a 7-year-old in establishment. I really do think that his brain is just completely mush.
Speaking of mush brains, Jared Moskowitz, quote, they should just rename it. This is before the strike last week. They should just rename it the Ayatollah Protection Act, because that's what it does. Speaking of the war powers resolution, that's the Dems are going to be voted on. So it is there's some bipartisan support for this sort of you support the terrorist blackmail.
Is he that guy from Florida?
Yep.
Larkin is
Oliver
running?
Larkin. We had him on Left Reckoning. We should get him on this show. Florida's 23rd, I believe.
Let's talk a little bit about this third way thing. And then maybe we can take a call or two. This is important because since prior to Kamala Harris losing the election, there has been a very quiet internecine war within the Democratic coalition that was being waged by the billionaire class. They folks like Mark Cuban and others, a lot of the AI people and even the crypto people have been weighing in and attempting to get rid of things like the movement we saw in labor and in antitrust within the Biden administration. They want to roll this stuff back. And they have a tremendous amount of money, but a very, very increasingly dwindling constituency to whom they sound reasonable, because there's just this massive wave of populism. Whether, you know, you can look up what's happening in Maine, you can look at what's happening in Nebraska, you can look at what's happening in North Carolina, 11th. Hopefully, but in New Jersey,
yep.
In Manhattan, across the board, this is happening, and they are fighting. And Bernie Sanders, like I said earlier, came out with introduced the idea of a wealth tax on billionaires that would be about 5% of their wealth annually. Now, that's probably like break even, right? Like if you put if you're a billionaire and you have hundreds of billions or even a billion, even hundreds of millions of dollars, and you put it in the bank, you're going to get about 5% interest on maybe like a 12-month CD. I would imagine you get special terms. And that begins to eat a little bit away, tiny, tiny bit at your wealth, not even. And we should have a lot of other structures that would inhibit the ability to accrue that kind of money. And the revenue from the tax would go to all sorts of like socially beneficial things. We'll talk more about the plan in the future, but it would provide direct payments to every man and woman making $150,000 or less in the country. It would stop 15 million Americans from losing their health care they currently have by reversing the Medicaid and Affordable Care Act cuts. It would expand Medicare to cover dental, vision, and hearing. It would eliminate the affordable housing gap and abolish homelessness in the United States. It would end the child care crisis. It would give teachers in America a raise. It would ensure seniors with disabilities are able to receive the home health care they need through Medicaid, all for just 5% of billionaires' wealth. Meanwhile, across town, the third way of folks are meeting.
It's actually in South Carolina. I saw on the sound sheet, which is interesting because, as people may remember, right, that there's an effort in within the Democratic Party right now to maintain this insanely self-serving decision that the Biden administration, the Biden campaign, tried to force the Democrat and did force the Democratic Party into to cement his power, which is keeping South Carolina as the first primary state.
The state Democrats don't win.
And it was such a big problem, too, because in New Hampshire, in their constitution, it says that they're supposed to be the first primary, or there's a law, maybe not their constitution. There's a law that says they're supposed to be the first primary. So remember, there had to be this write-in campaign for Biden there. Like, it caused major problems. So if you want to know what wing of the party is centered here in this third way conference, it's the loser Biden people that are trying to make sure that they still have influence within the Democratic Party.
This is San Francisco DA Brooke Jenkins. She's on stage with Matt Iglesias and Al Shus, Massachusetts congressman, and the mayor of, is it Cleveland, Ohio? Now, the mayor from Cleveland, Ohio, is pretty funny. Earlier, he has a pretty a clip that I think upset a lot of the abundance people, where he talked about the building that they have going on in Cleveland. With set-asides for union and for...
Yes. But Jenkins is the woman that was put in place after Chesa Boudin was recalled.
By reactionary fascist venture capital money.
Exactly.
And so here is that clip. You can hear her. I mean, it's so embarrassing how naked this is.
She's an agent for billionaires.
They are all on this same team, so nobody's embarrassed because it's all the way that they talk. This is all like a, I don't want to say a grift, but it pays well.
Yeah. Matt, I just want to say, I think you're touching on something. In San Francisco, we are at a reckoning point with the labor unions putting a wealth tax, or they're collecting signatures for a wealth tax. We, you know, we have the highest number of billionaires in the country, San Francisco, most of whom are Democrats.
Yeah.
Most of whom not only donate the most money to Democratic candidates, but also have extensive philanthropic records of giving money, to our city. And right now, our mayor, I will say, is very strong on the public-private partnerships, and they are investing millions of dollars into helping us recover. And so I think we are, you know, again, at a reckoning point in our party with whether or not we can continue to be anti-business, whether we can continue to alienate the people who, yes, have been very successful in this country, and we want them to pay their taxes and give what's due and give back, but at the same time, not making them the enemy, when we know that they are giving more than most, really, to, you know, the endeavors that we think are important, right? And making sure that our city, you know, when the president, you know, when the shutdown was affecting SNAP benefits, they are who stepped in and said, we are going to give the city $20 million to backfill, you know, what the administration took away from families who need it. And that has to be acknowledged.
You could probably use a few more billionaires, yes. Right? Yeah.
Cleveland is open and ready for business.
Thank you for acknowledging
that. They're going to move to Cleveland. They're going to move from San Francisco to Cleveland.
After she said donations, right? You could have just cut out the rest of the clip.
Yep.
She's taking money.
There's
from,
one operable word there.
Oh, David Sachs. Significant donors to the Chesa Boudin recall.
But it is amazing. I mean, just thinking about how, like, sort of how disturbing the vision of, like, this is like RoboCop stuff. Yeah. This is like futuristic, weird ass, like, we need to rely on these people. And they're Democrats. As if, like, she's saying they pay their taxes. The way that she's talking is exactly like a Republican.
Yeah.
I mean, exactly like
these
a Republican.
These are Republicans.
And the idea that we have to be worried that if we have a small wealth tax, a tiny, like, this we're talking like a small increase. It's the functional equivalent of putting a small increase on property taxes for McMansions, but actually narrower than that. But I mean, that we're in danger of offending people who have been giving money so that people can eat. Why are these people giving money so that other people can eat? If they want to do that, they can do that. Is it to stay in our good graces so that we allow them to accrue more and more money? I mean, this is such a demented worldview. It is disturbing.
It's demented by money. We would not know who that woman is if it wasn't for people like David Sachs and the venture capitalists that she's representing. So this idea that they should pay their fair share, she gets the share. It's paid for her. That's why we know who this woman is.
But let's also be fair that I think that she had this perspective and the money found her.
Right, but I didn't know her before that.
Right. Well, I mean, and I just want to illustrate this point because they have to lie, and I want to play this too, but just really quickly here. They have to lie right now to accomplish their goals because there's no appetite for Democrats right now to be talking about how we should be more respectful of the generosity of billionaires. It's absolutely insane that you're making that case. But they're pretending. So, like, Dave says this here, and I take issue with the framing of his tweet because there's been people that have pointed this out. Third ways ICE polling, overhauling ICE beats abolish 2-1 with this phrasing. But that's not what just what the phrasing says. If you look actually at what it's beating, what the overhaul is beating, it says we need to abolish ICE and halt all immigration enforcement inside the country. And they're pretending that their position is stronger than the actual text of what is said there. So they are obscuring the truth. And other people, I wasn't the only one that saw this and noticed this on Twitter, because abolish ICE has become essentially the majority position in the country. And the only way that they can explain that away is to be dishonest.
And I'm sorry, if you are a fool, if you think any one of those losers is actually going to hold ICE accountable in any meaningful
way. And honestly, what is like the words hold ICE accountable for violence and abuse and overhaul the agency, but not abolish it entirely? What are we maintaining? The name?
They'll do nothing.
It's like, no, but people are supporting that. Like the idea that you have 65% for holding them accountable and overhauling it. Like, what is it that they worry about abolish when it's halt all immigration enforcement inside the country? It's just absurd.
But with David Sachs, and I'm not sure who else funded this recall effort, but I would imagine that there was some Peter Thiel money behind it. They don't want ICE to be abolished. Peter Thiel's Palantir and other surveillance technologies are major contractors and are getting no bid contracts from this Trump administration to surveil us and take, and ICE is using facial recognition and retina scanning that all comes out of the Silicon Valley money that she is representing there and is saying that we should be more grateful for their donations that would be much larger if there was taxation. Like, that's the other point is like, we should be grateful that they give away any of their money at all. No, we shouldn't. We need to be making it mandatory and taxing them.
We should treat them like pinatas.
I don't think that those like Sachs and Peter Thiel are worried about abolish ICE at all. I think they know at the end of the day, they're going to be selling it, whatever agency is there. I think they have confidence in that. I think the reason why they do this is more about this internecine fight or internecine fight. They want to defeat those people who are associated with that. That is what's going on here. That it's, they see this as a way of making the choice between reasonable third way people and the George Floyd crazies who could take over the party. But
when they take over the party, it impacts capital. So it's just making the same point I'm making.
Yes, but I don't think they're worried about specifically that they have an I don't think they're worried about this specifically. It's more a way in which they can indicate and paint the crazies. That is what is going on here, I think, in that respect. But here is another version of that. Here is Jim Messina. This guy was an Obama campaign guy. He is
a Theresa May advisor over in the UK. That is
great.
The Tory party. Thanks, Obama.
And he was, I think, Obama's campaign manager for 2012. And here he is being interviewed. and explaining why Democrats are using losing young men. Now, what's unfortunate for him is that, like, the polling has shifted dramatically yep. on this.
Yep.
And he's also not aware of young men are increasingly bankrupt because of the things he's about to go through. But he's – see, this is what I'm saying is that, like, they talk about this stuff is just simply a way to signify to this audience, even if there's no data, they're creating a narrative.
Yes.
And so it doesn't – they're making up stuff. So it doesn't really – a matter in that way. But here he is telling his narrative, which is literally like, this is a, there's a lot of like, good to meet you, fellow kids, quality to this.
When you look at what we signal to these voters, most of the things they really like, we are against. Mm. Like, they view the Democratic Party as people who tried to ban TikTok and Donald Trump saved it. We're against online sports gaming, even though a bunch of blue states need the money. We're against prediction markets now. We're against a whole variety of crypto. Doesn't mean we shouldn't regulate those things. Doesn't mean we shouldn't look at those things. But how can on one side we say to people, your life is materially worse because big banks are going after you and all these things are making your financial life better?
Wait, what's going on?
That's it.
Oh, no, no,
oh,
no.
Oh, sorry. I thought it was restarted.
Big banks are going after you, and all these things are making your financial life better, and the system's rigged against you. But, oh, by the way, you can't do crypto, and if you do, you're a bad crypto bro. It doesn't work like that.
Oh, wait, wait a second. You know, actually, it works exactly like that. These, you're being taken advantage of. You're being scammed. You can't say that the banks are coming after you and then say, like, oh, because you want to go into a money laundering like industry where they are, where a big fish are like literally effing you over constantly.
Yeah, people love working for multi-level marketing schemes. You can't tell them no.
I'm trying to find that chart. We've definitely shown it on the show of the people under 30 or under 25 in their positions on gambling. Do you know what I'm talking about, Matt?
I'm not sure, but I know that the gambling rates are massively exploding. And I do think that has shown up in polling about people's attitudes towards gambling, mm-hmm. specifically younger people.
Younger people. So, I mean, we're going to look for it, but we can just take my word on it. When you look at how young people view gambling at this point, it is much more skeptically and much more critically in polling than the older generation. So as he's talking about, like, you know, being anti-crypto and being anti-gambling is in some way going to lose young men are starting to say, basically say, no, this stuff is really bad because maybe I know somebody in my life who's gone into debt from gambling.
It's epidemic levels.
Epidemic.
We are ruining young men's lives yes. with the thing that Jim Messina is flogging at that conference. Evil.
Yeah.
But let's
there's,
see. Here.
There's a chart that is specific to age groups as well.
A bad thing for the country. Here it is.
Here it is. There it is. 23 to 41. Thank you. There it is. Ages 18 to 29. That's the biggest shift in people that think that gambling is bad for the country. And he's on stage saying that the Democrats are going to lose young men.
And he has an interest in saying so because he works for the fucking betting company.
It's unbelievable. It's just counterfactual.
Just a reminder, the former head of the DCCC.
A lie.
Maloney. I can't remember his first name now. He is now the head of the. Sean Patrick Maloney. He is now the head of the Prediction Markets Trade Association. Prediction markets. It's just like, it's unbelievable. It's the gamble on anything that happens market.
Yeah. It's a sign of a sick economy that's been taken over by parasites. There's a today, 47% of men under 30, the guys who Messina's supposedly talking about, and that entire crowd of vampires is clapping about, under 30 say legal sports betting is a bad thing for society, up from 22%.
There
he said
you go.
It in 2022. In 3 years, it went from 1 in 5 to about half.
So do you think that he's actually thinking about what the Democratic Party should do to appeal to young men? Or is he acting on the interests of the board that he's on, which is worried that they are rapidly losing the trust of their key demographic.
So the entire Third Way Conference is that sort of same lie. But it, just to go back to the tax thing a second, Jabari Brisport had this to say at the New York State Legislature about the tax the rich stuff going on here. And this is pretty good way to phrase it, the decision we face here.
If we were to increase state taxes on these same class of ultra rich by $10 billion this year, would they be paying more or less in taxes than they were before H.R. 1?
We estimate that their tax savings from H.R. 1 sum to $12 billion. So in total, that would be less.
So we could raise $10 billion new state taxes this year on the ultra rich, and they would still be getting a tax cut from last year.
Correct.
Thank you.
Whoops.
Thanks, Jabari. If DSA ever does vote to primary Hakeem Jeffries, Jabari Brisport is a very good option.
I mean, you'll get full-throated support here.
Yep. Believe he's overlaps.
Even if he doesn't want you. If DSA decides I think march on these people.
Yep.
Well, if you're worried about their messaging, you can take some solace in the fact that 48 views, 356 views, 60. Let's see.
Yeah, but you know what? I think that fundamentally misunderstands who their audience is.
Yeah.
No, it's sort of like the CNBC and Fox Business. Like only like 5,000 people are watching at any given time, but they all buy Bentleys.
They're multi-billionaires. And millionaires.
So the advertising rates they get are huge. And that's what's, I think, going on there. They you know, if anybody points out to them, like, how come you only have 47 views on this? Oh, we're really big on Twitch.
Yeah.
And nobody that asked that question knows how to get to Twitch. And so they just trust. But it's literally for them to show. It's for them to show, the people in the audience.
Well, that's Barry Weiss's greatest skill is that she's convinced really, really wealthy men that she knows what the kids are thinking.
Yeah,
exactly.
Right. But I agree with everything you believe about billionaires and the left and Zionism, but I know how to communicate it to the children.
Exactly.
There's one here with zero views.
What's the topic?
It's got four, Brian. It's got zero comments, okay?
Oh. Yeah,
but like it said zero.
Actually says no view.
What's the topic?
Take five, colon, fighter. I don't know.
Oh. Fight. Let's
see. Gretchen Barton, founder of Worthy Strategies, breaks down the kind of fighter Americans are looking for.
Oh, for sure. A fighter. It's how they're going to simulate Bean Zora Mamdani without any of the social.
100%. I mean, it's the same thing with the affordability thing where, I mean, they just say affordability and then there's nothing else.
Should we play Melania at the UN?
I would like to, sure.
Okay, let's do that. This is, I think people are familiar with like give with one hand, take with the other. Well, here Melania is,
she's girl bossing.
She's girl bossing. She's at the United Nations to promote
her movie?
No, helpfulness to children internationally as her husband is okaying a bombing strike on over 100 girls at a school in Iran. But here she is at the UN. It's like it's always like, make a wish day. For everybody in the White
be
House.
Dead. Be dead.
Good afternoon. The 10,113 meeting of the Security Council is called to order.
Okay.
I've been allowed to represent the country.
I am here. I am Melania. I am Melania. I'm Melania. Hello. Hello.
It's like Latka. I mean, it really is. It's amazing. Yes. What would be honestly almost make the entire presidency worthwhile is if at the end, after Trump passes away, Melania just goes like this, and it's Andy Kaufman. That would be that would make it all worthwhile.
It's so funny to have a nativist fascist freak out, and the wife, first lady, is an immigrant that barely speaks English.
Probably came as undocumented.
Yeah,
I do like the God, that's Mike Waltz right behind her, right? Who's the actual UN American representative? They're just praying that she knows how to read. They're just praying, like, can she get through this sentence? I mean, that wasn't the clip I sent, I thought, but
Jobby Boonier, she's lived here for 30 years. Why the F does she sound like that? It is amazing that so much of the MAGA movement is built upon the idea that immigrants don't assimilate. And I have a theory about this. And my theory is that she has been pretending for decades to not speak English very well and not understand it very well. So she has to do as little communicating with her husband as possible.
I mean, I think that you're assigning a little bit too much strategy here. This is a very rich woman who's never been asked to, never been put in a difficult position outside of the bedroom.
Being married to Donald Trump is a very difficult position.
I mean, with anybody that would ask her to, like, need to be communicative with them.
We also birthed a 30-foot man. That's an uncomfortable position to be in.
I mean, that does sound uncomfortable, but maybe the length helped and it wasn't much. But
speaking of America First, you wonder who's getting the visas these days? Influencers and OnlyFans models dominate U.S. extraordinary artist visas. So, yeah, about half of these.
Well, I don't want to close the door behind me.
That's what she means by be best.
I don't want to close the door behind me.
Be trafficked very nicely. What? So why did she get to do this? Is this because she's not revealing the worst of Trump's Epstein
stuff?
Because
coupon code 777 gets you into my documentary. 10% off.
He's keeping her happy for some reason.
Folks, we'll take two phone calls at 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920. Sunset Lake PBD says there hasn't been this much fun in a fun half in a long time, despite the horrors of the past few days. Shout out MR crew. Bisexual lighting for man now. I can't believe Trump has slipped up and publicly said he bought Melania. What's that? I don't think I heard that. Calling from an 802 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from? 802.
Hello?
Hello.
Can you hear me?
Yes. Who's this?
This is Peter from Vermont.
Peter from Vermont. What's on your mind, Peter?
Actually, I was happy you guys brought up this third way thing because I've been meaning to call back about going after these all-in hammerheads. They're really annoying. I feel like I know you guys do a good job, like, clipping Dave Rubin and Tim Pool, but I mean, please, it's more than just David Sachs too, you know? These guys are like,
dude, do you watch it?
I used to before they became, extension of the administration's propaganda team, but.
Well, I have a suggestion that will help you actualize this. Yeah. Watch it. Send us clips.
Yeah, because I hate those guys, and it brings my blood pressure up to watch them.
You know, one thing they did that was just crazy, this was back, you know, when everything was going down in Minneapolis, but they were first in there kind of interviewing that Shirley guy, and they did this clever thing where they weren't really interested in his story, but they were very interested in, like re-inscribing it as like an argument for their crusade against the billionaires tax, citing that, you know, this is what happens when you give the government money. You
right,
know?
Right, right. I'm not surprised. I bet you Chris Rufo put them on. I appreciate the call. But like I
all
say,
right. All right, take care.
MajorityReporters@gmail.com. Send us, all you gotta do is send us the link and say this time code. Let's go to a 509 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
Is this me?
It sounds like it. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
Okay. This is Thursday. I'm from Evergreen, Washington State. Lovely area. First time caller, long time listener.
What's on your mind, Thursday?
So I am not too recently turned 27, and I just got to say, I remember watching your show as a youngin' during the Iraq War and Afghanistan War.
Oh, geez. Okay.
And, yeah, and I just got to say, the, like, temporal whiplash that we're seeing right now is mind-boggling. Mm-hmm. I've been working on a video essay script for about 2 months now, and I've had to constantly go back to the drawing board because, oh, first it was the invasion of Venezuela and the kidnapping of Maduro, still in jail, by the way. Then it was the oil hostage of Venezuela and exploitation of the arrangement with Cuba. And now it's Iran. It's just like, it's crazy. And I'm sorry, I'm like getting shaky right now, but like,
it's
horrifying.
Believe me,
it's
crazy.
It's
and yeah. There's images coming out of Iran right now that are absolutely apocalyptic because the bombing has continued.
Yeah.
Over the past few hours.
I've got a Mizrahi friend who is just having a rough time right now. It's difficult, but like I gotta say, listening to the show, Left is Best. I'm staying sane by the grace of God and your kind words. But like, I'm just having this. It's just like 20 years ago. It's just the most clear, broad as day, pretend towards a reason to just have war and feed the industrial complex for the military spending that just is a round tripping effect, a lot like the AI bubble, but like in a broader scheme. And I'm sorry if this sounds like super schizo. I'm trying to get
no, believe me. I feel the same way, and I can't believe we're back to this point again, and could be embarking on another decades long war, and we are bombing people like this again. Believe me, I appreciate the call.
Yeah, of course. One last thing: workers of the world unite.
There you go. Appreciate the call.
All right, take care.
Trombone guy, MR subscriber since 2011. It's my 68th birthday. May I please have a shofar? Trailing Seas.
Nice.
Yes, you can. Oh, wait. What's going on here? Oh, that was it. Here you are.
What Carrie Emden.
Folks, that signals the end of the phone call portion of our program. I said two callers, and I meant it. Got a couple
crime
of...
crimes?
There you go. You
got a
bonus
bit.
Crime crime. Exactly.
Crime crime?
Wool
crime.
Oh my God. What's she doing? Future reactionary. Oh, there's a lot of stuff here. I've copyrighted Tuesday, but I'll grant you all a perpetual license as long as Sam promises not to pivot the show to woodworking and or Apple critique. Badder worser. Tillis in the Gnome hearing just showed us how Democrats should be treating members of this administration. New Jersey mailman, the United States isn't at war with Iran in the same way Russia is only engaged in a small, limited special military operation in Ukraine. Jay Tingle, it was the Obama administration that compelled Spain to remove Judge Balthazar Garzon, who had previously attempted to prosecute Pinochet while the dictator was in England. Garzon also attempted to prosecute CIA agents who kidnapped people in Spain as part of the global war on terror. Cheney tried to get rid of the judge. Obama succeeded. There you go. Snarkorski. As the world descends into flames, I long for a simpler, stupider time when Republicans were merely outraged over Mr. Potato Head and Dr. Seuss. Indeed. Zane, if Iran got hit by anyone, they'd strike us bases. strike U.S. bases could be anyone, could be us, could be Israel, anyone. Annoying gay guy. Emma, this might be a little pretty, but your Oppo Neera Tanden is getting clowned on Twitter because she...
Petty.
Yeah, sorry. Because she was trying to stir up Graham Platner controversy and then like 10 minutes later retweeted Nick Fuentes and Matt Walsh.
Yeah.
Love you.
I mean,
that's great.
The nice thing
is that true?
The sun is setting on those idiots. Yeah, it's true. She Graham went on a podcast that apparently like previously.
No, the whole thing came from him retweeting that guy Stuart
Peters, which I guess, yeah, like who is just only slightly more rancid than a typical Republican,
but
was anti-war.
It.
Yeah, exactly.
Like I'm sorry.
Need to grow
you
the
can't,
fuck up.
You can't quote tweet somebody and that's supposed to be an endorsement. You could be responding to the clip. It's so infantile.
She retweeted Fuentes and Matt Walsh.
Yes. I believe so. That's let me double check.
But when she does it.
I have quote tweeted Aaron Rupar like hundreds of times. It doesn't mean I endorse everything he says. Like, it's so silly. It's so silly.
They're trying to Corbin him. It's this guilt by association
but
thing.
It's so...
You went on a podcast once that once suggested that maybe Israel killed Charlie Kirk, so therefore you're an anti-Semite. Grow up. No one cares about what you think.
It's also so desperate. And because it's Maine, like the distance between what Neera Tanden tweets... And what happens in a Maine primary? I mean, this is the thing that they still haven't learned. They kept inserting their own candidates into Maine. Was it Gideon last time around? Like all of these perfect candidates, according to sort of the Democratic establishment perspective on this stuff, and got destroyed. And they keep projecting. It's actually awesome in a way because in the same way that you were talking about, like where Mearsheimer says, like, you know, Israel has to project like total overwhelming strength because they need to show that.
Yes.
When they are harming themselves now because they're banging, like they're taking their gun and they're slamming against this sort of like iron wall and it's breaking their guns.
Yep.
Like there's a time where you got to decide like, you know what, I got to keep my powder dry because right here, I'm just going to use up my powder.
They've hurt the Western democracies significantly. The Labor Party wouldn't be where it is without this sort of, bullshit. And they're going to try to do it here too. And, you know, hopefully we can condition people to ignore these people entirely, because they are a huge problem for having an actual intelligible like discussion about any of these issues. They are liars.
Alex B, can you address Graham going on that Nazi podcast and telling the host I'm a longtime fan? I'm being genuine here. Like him, but fear Collins may have tons of Oppo on him. Okay. First off, I don't know what the podcast is.
It's not a Nazi podcast. It's a vet podcast, and they wondered, I guess, and I don't care enough to look even farther than this, but that Israel may have killed Charlie Kirk, which I'll be honest. Entertaining the idea that Israel does political assassinations, fine to me.
It's also, I think it's a bizarre theory, but the idea that he has listened to every utterance on a podcast and shouldn't go on a podcast... I mean, look, you can argue. I think that a candidate should be much more circumspect about which podcast he goes on. But if you are arguing that he is a secret Nazi, I can tell you that is absurd. That is absurd.
I think Trump went on a lot of podcasts. I think a lot of Democrats after Trump won were like, we need to get on podcasts. And now those same people are like, well, let's pour through. Let's put all their podcasts into AI and see the most problematic thing we can throw at this person. It's disgusting.
Not like that. And also, we need to win back young men, but not like that.
But even putting all that aside, all the premise of all this is that he's a secret Nazi.
Yeah.
And that is a function of... His Totenkopf tattoo, which we know about because he had promised his brother and his Jewish sister-in-law that he would perform some song, in his underwear at their wedding. I really think if he was a secret Nazi, he would have been a little bit more circumspect at a wedding with half Jews.
Yeah. And all the donations he gave to like Kamala Harris and the Democrats over the past 10 years, that was just to throw people off of the scent that he was.
And look, it's been reported. He was a fan of their show. He's a fan of Michael's show. He's a fan of Matt's show. Listened to it extensively. I mean,
that's how deep it goes, man.
And to be able to be smart enough to sort of build that alibi years before you become a candidate. I mean, that's what needs to be judged. You can say, if it is your opinion, that if someone had bad opinions 10 years ago, I will not vote for them. Or if someone doesn't know what a Totenkopf is, I'm not going to vote for them. That at least be explicit that that's the judgment. But make the case that he's actually a Nazi, and all the people who know him in Maine, and there would be plenty now, right? Like, that's Ryan can tell you, this Maine, you're not going to be able to hide who you are because everybody knows you there. Yep. This is a different situation. This is not like this is where he grew up. This is where he lived. I mean,
also a state where Paula Page was the governor. You can just be a Nazi and win.
That's the other thing.
Can we do a one shot? Yeah, okay. It's okay. I have an appointment, but we can. I'm sure we'll get a million more IMs about this stupid
garbage. You said
garbage.
240 and it's 237. I was about to land.
Well,
I'm over this
about this garbage.
People need to grow the fuck up. Honestly, like this.
I love you guys. I'm just like, come on.
The idea that Maine has this guy leading and they're not aware of all this stuff. No, they resent people like you. Like this, and that's everyone near a town into the ultra left. People don't give a fuck.
I don't even think they're aware of it.
I talked to Nathan Bernard, and apparently there's a lot of resent that people from around the country are trying to dictate narratives about their Senate primary. And I mean, it makes sense to me as a North Dakotan, people feel the same way. Like, and everyone who has these anxieties, whether it is an ultra leftist who thinks that the only solution is to read more theory and buy guns, or a Neera Tanden type, y'all are past. Goodbye.
Spaghetti brains, for the sake of 1,000 Fs, if Plattner was a Nazi, he wouldn't have to lie about it. Look around you. Nazis aren't hiding anymore. Grow up. Kaju Beetle. If people don't want a secret Nazi to win in Maine, then put out a candidate with better policies. Oh, wait a sec. Maine Postman. Bernie went on Joe Rogan. He must be a secret Nazi.
The same people said the exact same Bernie going on Rogan.
But that's even a different argument, right? Because that's an argument of how much Bernie is validating Rogan. It's a separate argument, it seems to me. I don't know if it's necessarily any more or less valid. But the point is that all of this is supposedly to prove that he's a secret Nazi. If you accept the fact that he is not a secret Nazi, all of this is just like, oh, he should go on different podcasts. I mean, that's basically what it is. But they cannot come out and articulate that, because once they do, it all falls apart. Why would you do this? It doesn't make any sense.
I think places like CNN and et cetera have a worse effect on the world than these fucking podcasts.
Dickhead. I could have made a shit load of money over the weekend if I could access Polymarket. The Jimmy. God, I love when Sam says, just remind people as a reminder. Jobby Boone, you're good to remember Weigel consistently misrepresents public opinion reporting about law enforcement and policy. He was always holding the rightward line on police funding in 2020, 2022. Carl Demsock, and has a much larger impact on their good thing. I don't know what that means. Okay. Two more. Krusty Gnome. Boots on the ground in Iran is a saying. Country is a fortress. Afghanistan, terrain on steroids. Probably go worse for us than Afghanistan. And the final IM of the day.
But what if Jesus comes back to help us?
MIDI doctors, please close the first half stream.
I did. It's closed.
your wish.
How about, hey, just a heads up, the fun half is, or the main half is, don't order me. Because I'll open this fucking stream right back up.
Well, you've hit on Brian's trigger.
I think we're all a bit tense.
Matt, Brian, Emma, great job today, folks. See you tomorrow.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in. And my pilot light shining bright. I get somewhere the choice is made. The option where you don't get paid for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I get somehow lost my drive.